So, good afternoon. It's just a wonderful, it's wonderful to see so many people here coming out to hear Arnie Van. And on this occasion today, which marks, of course, Israel Independence Day. So it's a real honor to be able to introduce this event and for us to be able to host this event in collaboration between the Alan D. Levy Center for Jewish Studies and the Nazarian Center for Israel Studies. We have a wonderful afternoon planned for you. This is the 17th annual Arnold Van Lecture in Jewish Studies. And it's a real pleasure, yes, it's 1999. It's a real pleasure today that the lecture will be given by Professor Van himself. Arnold Van is known to many of you. There's few words that it would be impossible for me to introduce him in a few words. However, I do want to say a couple of things that really, for me personally, as well as I think for UCLA institutionally, are important to recognize in understanding his legacy and his vision and his inspiration that he's had and the impact that he's had on so much at UCLA, and I would argue for Jewish studies and Israel studies globally. First of all, he's not only Professor Emeritus of Hebrew and Comparative Literature, he's taught at UCLA for over 50 years, I understand 57 years, I believe. Touched a generation among a generation of students. He's the author of more than 100 articles, and as well as books and book chapters on all aspects of Hebrew literature, perhaps best known for his work on the Nobel Prize Hebrew author Agnon, and a very important book that came out in 1968 called Nostalgia and Nightmare. He's worked indefatigably for his entire career on Hebrew and English literature, a wide range of topics related to modern Jewish literature and Jewish cultural life, and has been one of the most prolific thinkers at the forefront of bringing literary studies and Jewish studies together. It's not something that was obvious in the 1970s. It was not something that was already in existence. And so those of us, like myself, are building on this legacy. We're coming to centers and programs and opportunities that have been put in place by, I would say, a founding generation. And so for Arnie to be talking about the founding generation of Israeli literature, I also hear him as a founding generation for Jewish studies. And for me, that's so important at a university like UCLA, in the second largest and most diverse Jewish community in the world. So extraordinary. Now, in terms of what he's done institutionally, Arnie, as many of you know, was the first director of the Center for Jewish Studies in 1994. He was also the first director of Israel Studies, the Nazarian Center for Israel Studies. And he was the founder of a very important department at UCLA, the Department of Comparative Literature, of which there are a number of faculty here today from that department, and it's flourishing because, again, of some of the original work that Arnie did. So there's much to be celebrated today. There's much to be thankful for. And I do want to say a couple of words of thanks for those who have made this program possible. This event is co-sponsored by the Nazarian Center for Israel Studies and the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures, as well as the Department of Comparative Literature. It's made possible by a generous endowment by the Levy Center board member, Milt Hyman, who is also a former student of Arnie Van's, and his wife, Sheila, who are sitting over here. So Milt and Sheila. Not only for your generosity since 1999, but really the vision of endowing this lecture and the opportunity that we've had to bring scholars of Hebrew literature to UCLA annually. I do want to acknowledge as well a number of guests, particularly from the Alan D. Levy Center for Jewish Studies on our board. In addition to Milt and Sheila, we're joined by Alan Levy and his daughter Laura Levy Cohen, who I think are over here. We're joined by Jim and Lori Keir, who also made possible the directorship that I hold, which is the Sadie and Ludwig Kahn directorship of the Center for Jewish Studies. as well as a chair in Jewish studies that Professor Myers holds in the History Department on Modern Jewish Studies. We also acknowledge, I'd like to acknowledge Stephen Lesser and Elaine Lindheim as well, who I think are among the audience here. So it's great that we have so many of our board members as well. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and introduce my friend William Cutter, who is going to introduce Arne and also moderate and respond to the talk that we'll hear today. Just briefly, William Cutter is the Steinberg Emeritus Professor of Human Relations at the Hebrew Union College and the Jewish Institute of Religion, where he is also held the Paul and Trudy Steinberg Chair in Human Relations. And he is also was a professor of modern Hebrew literature and education and has taught at HUC since 1965. He as well has a significant institutional history as the founding director of the HUC's Rhea Hirsch School of Education. William Cutter is the author of nearly 200 articles on a wide range of topics, from literary theory to modern Hebrew literature to educational theory and health and healing. Just to mention a couple of his recent books, in 2010, Midrash and Medicine, which came out with Jewish Lights in 2010, as well as a book called Healing and the Jewish Imagination, Spiritual and Practical Perspectives on Judaism and Health. He's edited a number of critical volumes, actually on the work of Arne Band, and so I couldn't imagine someone more perfect to respond as a trained practitioner of literary theory and Hebrew literature than William Cutter. And so with that, I'm going to give the floor to Bill Cutter. Thank you so much.
It's appropriate in Jewish settings to have a lot of introductions. I apologize, but I'm flattered and have no choice, because afterwards we will have some dialogue and I'll kind of chair this. Arne, in addition to my prepared remarks, Arne has asked me to explain why I'm the only person in the room wearing a tie. I didn't read the New York Times this morning to see John Kerry without a tie, but more significantly for this occasion, this tie was given to me about a month before he passed away by Arne's personal favorite undergraduate student, Michael Signer, Alba Shalom, and my good friend. Michael finished his bachelor's degree with at least a minor, perhaps more, in Hebrew Lit, certainly in Arne Band, the year before I finished my doctorate in Hebrew Lit with the same party. So I'm going to keep it on, and it warms my heart, and I hope you understand that. The Talmud tractate Erevin, Mixtures, or many ways to translate that, has a charming little interaction among two scholars, and it contains in it a caution against creating arrogance in the presence of a great person. We are only allowed, says this one rabbi, to utter part of the praise for a person in his presence. I had learned this guideline, actually, as a young rabbinic student, as only half praise instead of part of the praise. And it's that misreading, if I may quote Harold Bloom, that permits me a convenient thought to introduce Arne a little more formally. In order to utter full praise for Arnold Band, we can utter half for his role today as lecturer, and the lecture namesake, and the other half for his role as today's guest lecturer. Today's scholar is a double winner, then, as are we here in this audience. But we can also utter half of our praise for him and share it with the woman who has accompanied him on his intellectual and academic journey, Aura, who sits today with us and whom we also celebrate. We can utter half for the Hyman family, Milton and Sheila, whose generosity has brought us to this day, and the other half for the speaker, our name bestower, and the man from whom you will, I promise, hear in a moment. I didn't know that Dr. Presnell would say this, but I will repeat that Arnold Band created Hebrew literature at UCLA. He made Jewish studies happen at UCLA. He developed the comparative literature department here at UCLA. He virtually invented the Association for Jewish Studies, which began as a little group in Boston at the Harvard Faculty Club and now numbers over 1,500 members, colleagues, and departments throughout the United States. Talk about a visionary. He is one of the few Americans who has doctored some of our era's leading literary voices in a tongue that isn't theirs, that is, in English, to Hebrew literary scholars who today dot the landscape of both popular and academic culture in Israel. I think he will argue that today that will be part of some of his comments, and if not, I'll remind him. He once composed, in describing the life of his old and best friend, Walter Ackerman, the notion of confluent myths, in which he discussed the Latin school background, the Hebrew language aspirations, or the English language hopes of immigrant people, the upbringing of a Jewish boy near the Back Bay, and all those scholars who have built on the notion to describe yet more confluences of this remarkable life. Whether it has been in the composition of beautifully etched scholarly articles, thoughtful essay gems like string quartets on issues of modern culture, or helping young students at the simplest, most basic level learn how to read Hebrew, Arnold Bann has brought his intricate literary gifts to literally hundreds of people, and through them, I dare say, to thousands. Arnold Bann has always been the person to call upon when I was associate dean at the Hebrew Union College and we needed someone to teach Greek philosophical backgrounds to Jewish tradition. We said, let's call on Arnie Bann. When we needed a Bible teacher who, since ours was on sabbatical, let's call Arnie Bann. When I was ill, let us call on Arnie Bann. He has been everywhere in the field of Jewish and related studies, has been honored as a scholar of distinction by the Jewish Publication Society, has had his key, at least 12 of his key essays published in Hebrew by a very important project at Ben-Gurion University, and I could go on and on. And oh, have I mentioned that he was my doctor father, my doctor parent in today's language, and my inspiration for the more than 50 years in which I've been teaching. He taught me things about literature and intellectual categories that I know you will hear about today. This is the best I can do, but it is only half of the story. It is only half of the praise that he deserved. Let's hear from him, the first decade of Israeli literature. Is that flat enough? Is that stable there? Okay.
No. Thank you very much, Bill. Obviously, I want to thank everybody who came to this afternoon. I see people of several generations reached their stage in life where I can talk with generations. I see people I have taught in many, many different places, and have abundant memories. I see people in a book group we belong to just today, reading on this Monday night, so some of them are here. I selected to talk about the first decade of Israeli literature, partly because, yes, today is Yom HaAtzmaut, and we should celebrate this wonderful event, and partly because people interested in Israel are interested in everything else except that which culturally made it possible, that is to say, the Hebrew language. You cannot imagine Israel without the Hebrew language. I will get to that. I will have many things to say in my talk. It is a Hebrew language state. The founding fathers spoke Hebrew, though, of course, the members of the Zionist Congress spoke German and English, not Hebrew. But it was the Hebraists, first in Russia, then in Poland, then elsewhere, who created this country, which from very inauspicious beginnings turned out to be the State of Israel, whose existence 68 years we celebrate today. The scholar Benjamin Harshav, the late scholar Benjamin Harshav, also a personal friend, who taught at Tel Aviv and then Yale, made an interesting statement that the greatest achievement of the Jewish people in the modern era is the creation of a viable Hebrew language, not a state. The creation of a viable Hebrew language. Many other nations, peoples have created states. They're all over the place. But nobody has recreated a language which is not only rich and viable, but uses its ancient roots to illuminate the modern period. So this is something very, very unique. I would like at this point to wander a bit into autobiography. Many of you people know me over the years, but there are certain aspects of this particular question which you certainly couldn't know. In 1949, which was 2 or 3 months after the armistice in the First War of Israel, I went to Israel to study at the Hebrew University. I was sent by the Hebrew College in Boston, where I had been trained for many years. I was given a fellowship to study there. So the war was over officially, on paper at any rate, in August, and I arrived in September. So I was there in the first year, and saw the state in its early stages, some of which many people have very little idea about. Let me simply mention a few things. The Jerusalem I came to was a desolate city. It was after the war. The population had dropped to about 75,000. Many people left during the war for Tel Aviv or Haifa. And Jerusalem was really a desolate city. At night, it was dark. There was nobody around. In addition to that, there was a very stringent rationing regime. There simply wasn't enough food to eat. The government created a rationing program, which has been written about endlessly, because they wanted to save the money to bring in more refugees, both from Europe, from the camps, and from the Arab nations where Jews were fleeing. There's very little to eat. The thrill was when we got potatoes for Passover. Before that, you didn't even have potatoes. Jerusalem had no water. The water pipes from Latrun were blown up during the war. The replacement pipe was very small. Water was delivered to your house twice a month. If you wanted to shower, if you were smart, you went to the YMCA. Most Israelis didn't go to the YMCA, but Americans did. And it was a tough time, but exciting. It was the first year that the Hebrew University opened after the war. During the war, the university was closed for about a year. Professors still taught in their homes, but because of the fighting and etc., the university was closed. The university opened again as a full curriculum university in September, October of 49, and I was in that class. It was also the first class taught there in modern literature by Professor Simon Halpin, who should be mentioned here because Simon Halpin, an American who came from New York, who had been in Israel, of course, before, was appointed the professor of Hebrew literature at the university, was the first one to teach Hebrew literature of the 20th century. Everything was previous. In addition to that, Simon Halkin was the first person to teach Hebrew literature at UCLA here in 1954. So when the program was opened up here in 1954, he was invited to teach, and he came in 54, and subsequently there are other people who came, including myself. So he has a place in the UCLA history, which of course probably is not known. In this group of people whom I met at the Hebrew University, I should mention one person who's totally unknown. His name was Yosef Rappaport. In those days, he was a friend, and we went to classes together. He, at that time, produced what was the standard textbooks for high school literary stories for high schools, and he taught me what to read. And I asked him, what are you reading? What are you people in Israel reading today? So I could read it. He told me, and produced over the next few months, three books. One was Moshe Shamir's Hu Halach B'Sadot, He Walked in the Fields, which came out in 47, which was enormously popular, was even turned into a play. I'll have some more to talk about it later. And then he told me about Samach Yizhar's Chirbet Chizeh, which had just come out in 49. A few words about that book. Chirbet Chizeh is a very short story, 40 pages. And it's a story, some of you know, I'm positive, either in Hebrew or in English. It's a story of fighting on the southern front in 1948. The Egyptian army invaded what was then Israel in 1948 from the south and was moving towards Tel Aviv. They had armor the Israelis didn't. Yizhar was a officer in that area. But the book isn't about Israeli heroism at all. The book, on the contrary, is a sad story about the evacuation of Arabs from an Arab village in the area, how the Israeli troops feel about evacuating people from their homes, and how they think about, when they're doing this, they think about Holocaust in the background. It's in the back of their minds. They are a few years after the Holocaust, they're involved in hostilities, and they are doing something of this sort. Chirbet Chizeh became, of course, one of the leading books, stories in Israeli life. And for those people who forget, as certain scholars have forgotten in the 1980s, forget the fact that in the very first months of the state, the existence of the State of Israel, the Arab problem was fully aware, was fully made aware by people in Chirbet Chizeh. Nobody was hiding it. It was there. It was discussed widely. It hasn't been solved. It is a problem. But to say that nobody thought about it over the years is, of course, incorrect. The third thing he brought to my attention was a series of short stories by Agnon, who had already interested me when I was a young man in Boston. But it was a different Agnon. The Agnon that I had read in Boston was a man who wrote mostly about the Hasidic world. The Agnon that in the stories which he presented to me from Sefer HaMaasim, the Book of Deeds, which had been coming out through the 1930s, was an Agnon who was working the Kafkaesque mode of expression. Totally different person, totally different personality, totally different mentality. So I had these three things. I had Shamir, who basically is writing a book about presenting the image of the Sabra. And I had Yizhar, the Arab problem, and I had Avnon, recommended by my then closest friend in Israel. You might ask, and let me stop here for a moment, how come I could read these things? I was a young boy when I went there. I was already in the university. But I took a year off from Harvard and went to Israel. How could I read these things? Did I come from a family which spoke Hebrew? No. Nobody at home spoke Hebrew. Nobody at home, my father knew some Hebrew, but nobody spoke Hebrew. Where did I learn this? To the extent that I could, upon coming to Israel, take advanced classes in Hebrew literature. Well, I've written about this, and I think it's important to stress this. I had good teachers, and I paid attention to them, which few did. I had good teachers, and they taught me. Mostly at the Hebrew College in Boston, but also previously that in certain Hebrew schools. And at this moment in my life, I think it's again worthwhile mentioning them. These are heroic people who did a great deal of cultural work within the Jewish community, starting with the 1920s when they all sort of came and created these schools. And people, of course, have forgotten them entirely. They created a whole generation of which I am part. One of the things that you always saw when you went around Jerusalem in those days was a sign which said in Hebrew, Dor Acharon LeShibud, Dor Rishon LeGeula. The last generation of enslavement and the first generation of redemption. This is a standard Zionist motto, which energized the thinking of the Zionist movement from its early days, and I'm more or less referring to, say, the beginning of the 20th century, when it became something active and concrete. The signs were all over the place. The truth of the matter is, if you see this sign today, some Israeli, intelligent Israeli sees this sign today, given the mood of life in Israel today, they will laugh. Because it expresses the enthusiasm and excitement of the creation of the new state. Its deeper philosophical meanings. And today, well, people have other things to worry about. Life is different. Two generations have passed. So those phrases, like Dor Rishon, Dor Acharon LeShibud, Dor Rishon LeGeula, are interesting examples of how times have changed. It's again, for instance, the song everybody knows, Anu Banu Arsa Livnot Ulehi Banot, we have come to the country to build and to be built, which everybody learned in their childhood, or they should have learned, and probably most of you can sing. But people say it now, it's said ironically, it's like a joke. Who would sing it today with a straight face? You couldn't do that. You'd start laughing. Because the idealism of the Zionist movement, of course, has faded over the years, as does the idealism of any revolutionary movement. The morning after the revolution is always very difficult. Now, back to Harshav. He and others, including, say, Shaked, who did the most fundamental work on the study of the writers of the first decades of the state. Ordinarily divide for intellectual reasons the growth of Hebrew in the modern period into three periods. There's the period of the Haskalah from the 18th century to the end of the 19th. Then there's the period of what we call the Chiyah, the revival period. We all have been brought up in that. And then there is the state from 48 on. I want to call attention to certain aspects of the second period. In the first decade of the last century, of the 20th century, the writers who came and settled in Palestine of the period, which was then already called the Yishuv, were very few. One could name Brenner, Barash, Baron, Agnon, people who came in the 1910-1908 period. But the interesting thing is, in this period already, there existed the structure of a educational system in the community. This has been written about in great detail and skill by Aryeh Sapoznik, who was the center director, Center of Israel Studies director here. He wrote a wonderful book on this. In the year 1900, there were already 20 schools in the Yeshua where Hebrew was taught by a modern method called Hebrew in Hebrew, modern method of Hebrew. Such important institutions as the Gymnasium Herzliya, the Gymnasia Ivrit in Jerusalem, the Herzliya in Tel Aviv, were created in 1904, 1905, 1906. The Lemel Teaching School was created in 1906, 1907. In other words, in the early first decade, the basic institutions of a culture were created. And they already existed there. There were, of course, schools in Europe. But most European Jews did not speak Hebrew. They spoke Yiddish. And I don't have to go through the contested relationship between Hebrew and Yiddish, the different political goals. But the point is, there was already, in the first decade, a Hebrew community, a Hebrew community. How many people could really speak Hebrew? A couple of thousand. That's all. Mostly kids who learned in school. Very few people could actually speak Hebrew. I would like also at this point, in passing, to call attention to a letter, which is really an introduction to a book that Bialik wrote and published in 1917. Bialik, of course, was the great poet. In this city, if you say Bialik, you always think of Mayim Bialik, not Chaim Lachman. But Bialik wrote many great poems. He was, in many ways, the spiritual leader of the Hebrew movement. When you had a Zionist Congress, which was held usually in Switzerland, the first two or three days were entirely in German. In the last day, they had a session devoted for Hebrew, and Bialik led it. Now, the Hebraists were really a minority there, but they became the dominant figures afterwards. Bialik in Odessa in 1917 is putting out a new volume of collection of articles and stories called Knesset. And at that time he says, he's talking about the situation, as if redemption has come. He uses the word redemption again. Why? because this is 1917 after the February Revolution. In 1915, the Russian government forbade the publication of anything in Hebrew or Yiddish in the entire Russian Empire. So for almost 2 years, you could not publish Hebrew or Yiddish because they thought they were subversive languages. Maybe Jews on the other side of the line, on the Austrian side of the line, would be sending messages in Hebrew to somebody in the Russian side of the line. You could not publish Hebrew for at least almost 2 year period. When that government, the Tsarist government, was overthrown in that period, Yalik puts out this periodical, and he's writing an introduction as if history has changed. We have freedom all of a sudden. We have redemption. We can read Hebrew again. We can publish Hebrew. We can communicate in Hebrew. Ironically, in the same year was the October Revolution. As a result of the October Revolution, Hebrew, after several years, again was eliminated as a possible language. And Bialik himself, with all other Hebrew writers, were forced to leave the country in 1921, and most of them settled at the time in Berlin. Now, why am I stressing these various points? The question is this: how is it possible that when we get to 1948, the period that really interests us, we have a Hebrew-speaking society? Where did they come from? How many were there? How did they create a Hebrew-speaking state, which we are celebrating today? Well, this is step by step. By 1920, you had maybe 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 people in Palestine. Hebrew was already recognized by the British as one of the possible legal languages. But how many people spoke Hebrew or read Hebrew? A few thousand, not many. The numbers increased over the years. And an interesting thing happened, which is not found in almost any of the historical books. We talk about the creation of the state, of the Hebrew state, of the Hebrew community in Palestine, without thinking about what happened at the same time outside, what happened in the diaspora. Well, ironically, the largest Jewish communities in the world, of course, were former Soviet Union, former Russia. After the war, first of all, it becomes Poland, America. The interesting thing is that Hebrew as a viable language in these places seems to wither and die. To the extent that between 1924 and 1928, the center, the hegemonic center of Hebrew literature in the entire world is already in Tel Aviv. It's in Tel Aviv because all the other centers died or were eliminated. It's a sad story, but that's what happened. In the 30s, of course, many more Jews got to Palestine, many of whom, though this is always considered the German Aliyah, many of them were Polish Jews, Romanian Jews, who knew Hebrew well. So by the time the state was created in 1948, there was already a sizable Hebrew-speaking audience. Incidentally, there were very few Hebrew writers left in Europe. They had all left. So that when you look at the list of those people who were killed in the Shoah, very few of them were Hebrew writers. They weren't there. They were already in Palestine. Thousands of Yiddish writers were killed, but very few Hebrew writers were killed. Now, I'm pointing all these things out as a background to the sudden creation of an Israeli literature. I mention the fact that when I came to Israel, I was introduced to several books. One of them was Hu Halach Basadeh by Moshe Shamir. Moshe Shamir's book was the most popular book in the late 40s and throughout the 50s. It is a book about a young chalutz type, a sabra, the quintessential sabra named Uri, who spends his time working the soil, being active in defense groups, and by the end, incidentally, he himself is killed trying to save a friend. He dies at the end. But he is presented as the sabra type, the quintessential Israeli. This is the real, true Israeli. And he was accepted as such by the readership of the country. And this figure of the sabra, as we know it, as portrayed in Hu Halach Basadeh, basically was fairly dominant until the middle 50s. Ironically, where did this person come from? Where did this image come from? Well, part of it was all based on actual facts. People, young men mostly, and some women, were indeed involved in activities of this sort. And they were people of that sort who worked the soil, who had the ideals, belonged to the youth movement, were fighting, were members, became members in the 40s of the Palmach thing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, it was a type, and Moshe Shamir writes about this, it's a type which they picked up from Russian literature. And it was from Russian literature, not of the Tsarist period, it was really Russian literature of the communist period. Because many of the books which they were reading in the youth movement were books which were translated into Hebrew, because these people didn't read Russian at all. They were translated into Hebrew about heroic figures saving the soil, working the soil in the Soviet Union, fighting the Nazis, etc., etc. And this figure of the heroic national hero of the labor movement from the Soviet period was easily transferable to the sabra. The sabra really has a lot of Soviet background to it. Now, as time went on, as the state develops, all the institutions of the state start to take form. We have to begin to think of what happened in the first years of the state. First of all, there was a war, a very disastrous war. People forget how disastrous it was, but 6,000 people were killed, 1% of the population. Imagine if 1% of the population in the United States is over 3 million people. It's a small group of people. 1% of 600,000 is 6,000. In addition to which, there was a huge influx of immigrants brought in deliberately, both as part of the ideal of Zionism to build the Jewish state, a homeland, a refuge for Jews all over the world. Many of these people were survivors of the camps, about 250,000. Many came from Arab countries, Iraq, Morocco in particular, some from Yemen. In addition to which, as I said, there was very strict rationing. Life was very, very difficult. And in this type of atmosphere, the ideals of the so-called sabra didn't seem to be realistic anymore. People were trying to make ends meet. There was now a government which collected taxes. There was a government which also drafted people. You didn't volunteer anymore for the army. You were drafted. the entire, all the coordinates of life changed within a two-year period. As a result of which, by the time you get to something like 1952, you begin to discover that the ideals of the Sabra, the ideals of the pre-state period, no longer were sustainable, and people writing about people of that sort did not find a very ready audience. Yes, they continued. Many Sabra stories continued for the next 20 years, but they did not attract the more advanced writers. Already in 1952, there was a group called Likrat, mostly centered around the Hebrew University, a young man, one or two women, who created a new small literary movement whose position was we now have a world of individuals, no longer the collective, and the basic conflict between the individual and the collective was very strong, and we have to write for that world. We have to write to reflect the world we have. If we move ahead again, not many years, to 58, we begin to find the early stories of Aleph Bet Yehoshua, who was well known to most of you, who also we have had the fortune of having spoken here, who is, at that time as a young man is writing stories which are very, very Agnonesque. These are stories that sound like Agnon of the Kafka period, which is totally different from the socialist realism that you find in Shamir. Now, I'm just citing two possibilities out of many. Further research has indicated that there were many other styles being developed in this period or the first decade. But one thing is very clear. The first decade becomes a decade of greater variety. The socialist realism period, which held up the Sabra, was dying, and more individualistic type of writing of all sorts was available and was being presented. It's very interesting when you read histories of the period on the literate, and the best one, of course, is Gershon Shaked. He details in great acumen what's going on, but he forgets one particular thing, which is very strange because he also, like I, had written greatly, abundantly on Agnon. The most important writer, the most published writer in Israel in 1950, 1951, 1952, 1953 was not Shamir, it was Agnon. It's very strange, you might say, in the early years of the state, the person who was most written about, who was winning all the prizes, was not a Sabra, was a very peculiar but talented Hebrew writer, Agnon. I'd like to call attention just to some of the books of the period, because the one in particular, 1950, he published Oreach Natalalun, A Guest for the Night, which some of you, I hope, have read, in which he talks about a trip that he supposedly made, he actually did make a trip like that, back to Eastern Europe, to his town. And the book was published in serials in 1938-39, but was finally published as a regular volume, re-edited by Agnon in 1950. It's a devastating book, a description of what life was in the Jewish towns of Eastern Europe between the wars. Devastating book. And this book came out in 1950. The next year, Agnon republished his great novel, T'mol Shel Shom, which talks about the second Aliyah. It's also a book which doesn't have a happy ending at all. The next year, he published a book including many of his Kafkaesque stories. And the year afterwards, he publishes the 7-volume second edition of his works. In other words, the first 4 years of the State of Israel, the central figure was Agnon, not Moshe Shamir. The person who was written about most, the person who won the prizes, was still Agnon. He was a man in his 60s. Now, why is this important? This brings me to the question of Aaron Appelfeld. Aaron Appelfeld, who is still alive and has published at least 4 books, I lost count after 40, still alive, still in Jerusalem, who also has been a guest here and a good friend. He is the leading Israeli writer on the Holocaust. Okay? Perhaps one of the leading writers in general on the Holocaust. However, over the years, he has never really been well received in Israel. The truth must be said. Even today, though he's won every prize there is, when he publishes a book in Israel, he may sell 15,000-20,000 copies. Amos Oz will sell 80,000 copies. If he publishes in German, he'll sell 50,000 copies. But he doesn't have an audience in Israel. In a certain sense, there's a feeling he really isn't one of us. He's not a Sabra. And even though the image of the Sabra has died a long time ago, nobody talks about it anymore. It was the central image of who halach l'sadot. But Appelfeld is not a Sabra. Let me talk about a few things about his life and why I find it so particularly compelling and forceful. Appelfeld was born in 1932 in Bukovina, which is far to the east. As a result of that, the Jews of Bukovina, who with the coming of the Nazis were deported, they were deported to the east. Very few people in this country know anything about the destiny of the Jews of Bukovina. 750,000 of them who were deported to the east. We know about Auschwitz, we know about Treblinka, because that's to the west. But the ones who were deported to the east, to the area which was called Transnistria, which is that area beyond the Dniester River, we don't know about. There's a lot of literature on it in Hebrew, but that's next to nothing in English. Now, Appelfeld came from Bukovina, from the town of Chernivtsi. Chernivtsi was a major city in that part of the world. Today, it is in Ukraine, like everything else in that area is. But in those days, it was Romania. And he was brought up in German. He knew no Hebrew as a boy. Brought up in German. Middle-class family. My father was a business agent. When the war broke out, at first, that area was occupied by the Russians under the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, that part of the country was going to the Russians. So in 1940, Oppenfeld went to a school in the country where his grandfather lived, and he only went to the school 1 year in his life before he went to the university. But the interesting thing is, the school that he went to, in a certain sense, saved his life, because it wasn't a German-speaking school. It was a Ukrainian-speaking school. So he knew, in the first grade, he knew Ukrainian, and that's how he passed. When the war broke out, and the Germans then came in 1941, immediately his mother was killed. He and his father were taken to first the ghetto in Chernivtsi, and then to a concentration camp in Transnistria. Aaron himself escaped. God knows how. He was a little kid. He got out under the fence. And he spent the next 2 years, 42, 43, wandering alone in the forests, in the fields, from one farmhouse to another, looking for food and work. By then he was a kid, 11, 12 years old. And he survived. And he could survive for one reason, well, several reasons. Obviously, he had the strength to survive and the cleverness to survive. But also, his first year in school was in Ukrainian. He could speak Ukrainian. He wasn't only a German speaker. Incidentally, he didn't know Yiddish either at home. He only knew German. He had heard Yiddish from his grandfather, but not from his parents. His parents were Viennese-oriented, German-speaking Jews. Now, the part that interests me in particular is the part I would like to read to you. It's part of an article that I wrote, because I find it very crucial. The question is, how does this guy, with this kind of a background, become a major writer, the major writer in Israel, of fiction having to do with the Holocaust? Where did he learn Hebrew? The crucial years for our consideration of this problem are 1946-1956. The years between Oppenfeld's arrival in the pre-state Yishuv and his graduation from the Hebrew University. So he comes, he gets somehow or other, he wanders from the Ukraine when he was liberated. He wasn't liberated. The Germans retreated. He was picked up by the Russians and made into a kitchen boy in the army. And then somehow or other, with a bunch of other Jewish kids, they start wandering westward in 1944. They're picked up by people from Bricha and Sokhnut. They're brought to Yugoslavia, and they're brought to Italy, and finally they're brought to Eretz Israel, to Palestine. These are kids who were wandering around, who had lost their families. What did they speak among themselves? Well, a bunch of kids, most of them probably spoke Yiddish. That's probably where Oppenfeld began to learn Yiddish, because he didn't know Yiddish before he spoke German. While exact dates are hard to come by, we can divide the period when he's in Israel into four sections. In 46-47, he was in various institutions of Aliyat HaNoah. That's before the state. He was picked up and brought to Israel on a ship in 46. First of all, they were dumped off in Atlit in the British camp, and then they were brought into Aliyat HaNoah, where he began to learn Hebrew intensively. German was his native language in Chernivtsi, but during and shortly after the war, he learned some Yiddish, some Ruthenian, and some Italian. From 48 to 49, he was mostly in the agricultural school established by Rachel Ben Zvi in Talpiot in Jerusalem. Some of you may know that school. He was there for several months, and he was also in Nahalal. He often recalled seeing Avnon visiting the school in Talpiot. Avnon lived in Talpiot. they would wander around and visit the school. Apophel was a kid. He sees an older man who's considered an important writer. It sort of attracts him. He learned about Agnon when he was there. He couldn't read him, but he knew there was such a person existed. Apparently, during this period, he began to attempt to write in Hebrew, first in poetry. During the next 2 years, 1950-51, he did his military service, and though these were recalled on the whole as desolate years, he did succeed in publishing his first poem in 1952. But in that year, when he was in the army, he was reading Oreach Metalalot. He was reading Agnon's major novel, dealing with Eastern Europe, the one that I mentioned already, A Guest for the Night. From 53 to 55, he enjoyed several productive, liberating years at the Hebrew University, where he was encouraged in his study of Yiddish. That's where he really picked up Yiddish well, in the Yiddish class at the Hebrew University. And the world reflected by Dov Sadan, his professor at the university. Dov Sadan was also my professor. And by the Yiddish writer Leb Rochman. Rochman wrote a magnificent Yiddish memoir of Holocaust survivors hiding in a town near Warsaw. It's available. According to recollections published in Sipur Chaim, Apophel wrote several books of autobiographical memoirs. He visited Agnon frequently during those years. During his university years, Agnon was widely hailed by the professors he most admired, Sadan and Sholem, for instance, as the greatest Jewish writer of the generation. Agnon was considered that in the early 50s. So in other words, a young man starting out on his way, writing in the early 50s, goes to the university and everybody's talking about Agnon. So obviously, he has to learn how to do that, to be that writer. From that period on, Apophel established his home in Jerusalem, thus recuperating the stability of place he lost in the fall of 1941, when driven into the ghetto of Chernivtsi. Finally, he has a home again, that's in Jerusalem. Ironically, several years later, he saw in an Israeli newspaper in the 1950s, those of you who have lived through that. In the 1950s, the newspapers in Israel were carried lists of people who were seeking relatives. And he found the name of his father. His father, from whom he was separated in 1942, showed up in Israel. His mother, of course, was dead, but his father showed up in Israel and was indeed living in Jerusalem several blocks from him. Those things happen. Apophel's struggle to become a Hebrew author involved not only learning the language beginning in the late 1945 or early 46, but confronting the prevalent ideology of the various Zionist organizations and individuals who fostered and represented Hebrew in those years. For them, Yiddish was an anathema, and the refugee youth had to be Hebraized and, in a sense, Sabraized. He's written about this at great length and with great bitterness. Part of the story we often don't hear. But the educational institutions, through the Jewish Agency, goal was to take these refugee kids and to make them into Sabras. Sounds ridiculous, but that was the ideology of the time. As Apophel understood this cultural situation and has written about it repeatedly, often bitterly, this educational attempt to undo the trauma of the Holocaust by ironically erasing the language and ethos of the victims and replacing it by an assertive Hebrew actually traumatized him by forcing him to erase, to forget, and repress what he remembered of his past or his home and parents. Forgetting and recuperating memory are motifs found pervasively throughout Apelfeld's fictions and essays. Now, a young man setting out to write Hebrew fiction in the early days of the State of Israel had a variety of models to choose from, but they fell into two streams. One stream, of course, was the Sabra. The other stream was the anti-Sabra, or something that's different. Now, there were older writers who were not Sabras, like, say, Abnon and Hazaz, who were still popular. And Apelfeld could not write in the style of Moshe Shamir. Moshe Shamir was a foreigner to him. Moshe Shamir did not consider Apelfeld either as an Israeli, because he was one of them. Hazaz never seemed to interest Apelfeld. Agnon was clearly the great Hebrew writer of those days. Now again, in 1950, Agnon published a revised version of Oreach HaTalmud, A Stranger for the Night, for which he was awarded the Bialik Prize. Incidentally, that book, Oreach HaTalmud, was called, with an ironic name by certain critics, it was called Sefer HaShoah Lefnei HaShoah. It's the book of the Holocaust before the Holocaust. In other words, it doesn't talk about the Germans, it doesn't talk about concentration camps, it talks about the disintegration of the Jewish community as Agnon saw it in the early 30s. And he wrote about it in 38, 39. But for many people, that was the best expression of the Holocaust. And Apelfeld, of course, was interested in that. In 1953, Agnon published the second edition of his collected works, all seven volumes. Briefly, a young, ambitious author in Israel in the early 1950s would certainly be aware of the overwhelming stature and versatility of Agnon, often proposed for the Nobel Prize by Israeli critics. Side story. In the early 50s, Israel Hutz, the Israeli Foreign Office, in his infinite wisdom, said, "Well, we have a state, now we need a Nobel Prize winner." Okay, we have Agnon. We're going to make Agnon the Nobel Prize winner. So they didn't know how you do this. They sent Agnon to Stockholm in 1953. The result was Agnon got a heart attack and had to be taken home. He did get the Nobel Prize in 67, but it had nothing to do with his 53 trip. The leading prestigious author of Israel could write about non-Sabra experiences, so could Aharon Apelfeld. So Agnon gave license to him to write about non-Sabra stuff. Because other people were writing one way, he was going to do the other way. Now, the reason why I think it's important to understand what's going on with Apelfeld in the early years of the state, which we are celebrating now, is the fact that there were people who were left out. Most of the population was new. Apelfeld was one of many like that. With these contexts in mind, we can turn to what Apelfeld himself wrote about Agnon. In his first brief article in Massa in 1964, he presents three reasons. One, Agnon inspired him to return to the locale of his childhood. That is what informs him and shapes one's existence throughout life. Two, Agnon reintroduced him to the Jewish myth, that is to say, the totality of Jewish lived experience which sustains one's identity. You have to understand, Appelfeld had no Jewish background. Zero. Zero. He was brought up in a home, yes, he had a grandfather who prayed, but his parents were totally secular. So here's a kid who was speaks only German, is picked up by the Nazis, goes through what he went through. What is the Jewish quotient in this? What does he know about being Jewish? He doesn't. He had nothing. Agnon gave him ideas in that direction. It basically informed him through his example, you have to have a cultural background. You don't have one. Three, Agnon legitimates the expansion of perspective beyond the constrictions of the Eretz Yisrael and relatively current events. Now, Appelfeld wrote several volumes of autobiographical essays. One of them is called Masot Beguf Rishon, Essays in the First Person. Appelfeld returns to the impression that the original reading of Agnon's Arayat Natalim's Best for the Night made upon him and talks about it in great length. Again, he calls it, again, Sefer HaShoah Lefnei HaShoah, the book of the Shoah before the Shoah. Interesting. The chapter in Masot Beguf Rishon entitled Hagarin attempts to describe how certain powerful authors, Agnon, Brennick, Nesson, and Fogel, analyze in their fictions the disintegration of the kernel of Judaism in their days that affected the Jewish intelligentsia. And you find, those of you who know Appelfeld know a great deal has to do with Viennese Jews, Habsburg Jews, before the war and the disintegration of life there. He identifies closely with Agnon since the novel Arayat Natalim describes the desolation of Galician Jewry. And Galicia was geographically close to Bukovina, where Appelfeld was born. This novel and other stories situated in the author's hometown impressed upon Appelfeld the importance for a writer of having a hometown to inhabit in his imagination and his fictions. Interesting point. It's hard for us to imagine what's going on in this kid's mind. He knew nothing beyond his childhood home, which was limited. At the age of 9 or 10, he's sent to the country to be with his grandfather because the Russians have taken over. He goes to a Ukrainian school. Next year, the Germans come in, his mother's killed, his father and he are taken to concentration. What does he know about anything? He does have vague memories of his childhood, but he had no idea of what a Jewish community is. He had nothing. 1994-95, many of these same themes are repeated in Sipur Chayim, his biography, and in the autobiographical novel Ha'isha Lo Pasat Lishon. At two instances in the later book, the herald, who's called Irwin Aaron, and Aaron's Appelfeld's original name is Irwin or Erwin. He writes a novel in which he's the main character. Expresses his amazement at the seductive beauty of two Agnon passages. He's constantly talking about it. But then he says, I knew that this enchanted melody was not mine. He couldn't write like Agnon because Agnon, it is impossible to write about the ghetto, the hiding places and the forest with this composure. But of course, that is what he says. In many of Agnon's stories, there's a certain sense of terror and jangling. If one peruses even the seven volumes of the 1953 edition, one finds much material that does not evoke the world of the pious and the militia. If
If one merely looks at the volume in which Tehillah was first collected, Ad Hina, one finds in all sorts of Kafkaesque stories which Appelfeld was obviously reading. Now, it's clear that Appelfeld not only was studying Agnon, learned a great deal from, was the major writer in his formative years. And I want to end up by reading a section from a autobiographical memoir by Appelfeld. Any discussion of the Agnon-Appelfeld nexus must end on a reference to chapter 26 of Sipur Chaim, which is devoted to Appelfeld's account of his last visit to Agnon several months before the latter's death in 1970. He would visit it in his house. That was a period in which I also visited Agnon very frequently because I was looking for material in my book. In the narrative opening gambe, he tells us, several months before Agnon's death, I was passing by his house in Halpiot. One window was open, and music burst forth from it. I felt something was wrong. I walked about near the window, but did not dare knock on the door. When he does knock, Agnon opens the door, invites him in, and prepares coffee. The rest of the chapter is framed as the last visit of the student with his master. I loved Agnon's writing since I first became acquainted with him. He was my guide in the great confusion in which I was mired at the beginning of my way. And though their conversations had often been strained over the years because of Agnon's habitual irony, that evening Agnon was different. And he plied Appelfeld with simple questions about his wartime experiences, the forests, and how he survived in them. This is Agnon without himself, he says. That evening he sought to tell me what my parents had not told me, and what I was prevented from hearing because of the war, as if he said to me, every writer must have his own city, his own river, his own stream. But instead of learning from them, you learn from the forest. That evening there stood before me an old man who knew that he would endure for a long time, that what would endure for a long time would be that voice, which had no ambiguity or cleverness or irony, but the voice he inherited from his ancestors, the voice of B'dmiya Meha or Tehila or Rechna Talalun. That evening he spoke to me in the tone of his ancestors, a fragment of which my ear absorbed from my grandparents in the Carpathian Mountains. It was late and I sought to go, but Agnon delayed me and said, stay, why are you hurrying? And he revealed to me that evening that he had been thinking about his parents in recent months. If he now had the time, he would go back and tell about them in an entirely different way. But now writing is difficult for him. And thus I left him. My heart told me that I would not see him again, and the heart knew what it guessed. The sensitive reader of this passage must realize that he has just read a chapter in an Appelfeld novel in which Agnon is now a character, in which one hears echoes of an Agnon story. This chapter invites us to revisit the Agnon-Appelfeld nexus, thus reopening a rich vein in Appelfeld research. Further research in this area will certainly do much to establish Appelfeld's oeuvre as an integral part of Israeli literature, no longer the writing of an outlier than that of Agnon. Thank you very much.
I'm going to stay here if it's all right. I know some folks may have to leave, but we're going to allow some moments for questions. I just want to start with one kind of challenge. It's a good thing for a student to challenge a teacher. It seems to me that one of the struggles, Arnie, of all writers in Israel since the 50s has been to establish themselves as not part of the cliché. Is Appelfeld that different from other writers who have tried to escape thank you, Todd. We have a very good microphone. I'm really asking this question to stimulate you all. We'll have to spend some moments with your questions. Arnie, are you up to a challenge?
Sure.
It seems to me that many writers, poets and prose writers, since the 40s have tried to escape the cliché of the Sabra, what was called in Hebrew the watchman on the ramparts, so to speak. Hatzofel levei Israel in Hebrew. Appelfeld is part of that, is he not? In spite of the fact that he may be unique, isn't he part of that trend to break away from the responsibility to be the new man, the Zionist hero?
There's no question, you're asking a very good question, there's no question that he is part of that tendency to break away from the Sabra image. And a lot of people have done it, one after the other. If you look at all the major Hebrew writers that you probably know, they're all more or less breaking away from the Sabra image, which they were brought up in the youth movement. The difference is this. Even among these people, Appelfeld was considered an outsider. Even among those other people, there's something about him that's different. In other words, he was there. He was in the forest for 2 years. They don't know how to understand him. And indeed, if you see the range of stories he's written, 40 plus books, he's written about a lot of things. And a lot of things have nothing to do with the Holocaust. They have to do with the survivors of the Holocaust who live in Tel Aviv.
Or predecessors
to the Holocaust. But there's a certain distinctive voice to him, which is not their voice. He knows many of these people socially, and they're very good friends. But he's different. He's just different. He comes from them. And you can't get away from a certain ugly prejudice that came to us from the Sabra tradition regarding survivors. Okay? Those of you who know well what Saboniim means.
What?
Saboniim means.
Sabon.
Sabon. It's a Sabra word which means soap.
Soap.
Survivors were called soapies.
Right.
Okay? It's ugly. It's ugly. But in Sabra slang, that was one of the ways, not the only way, referring to, that lasts for generations. It doesn't erase itself.
Thank you. We have a question, so I'm going to... yes, sir.
First of all, thank you for your eloquent speech. Glad to finally meet you in the presence. And I have a problem that bothered me for many years. I read Adnan, and there's a line that starts one of his stories, and I don't seem to be able to find out which story. I thought since you specialized in it, you might be able to remember.
I'm going to repeat the question for those in the back.
It starts with Yafim Leilei Iyar.
The nights of the month of, the evenings of the month of Iyar are beautiful.
Yeah, that is in one of his short stories, in Sefer Maasim. The exact story, I don't remember. I can find it.
What's in Sefer Maasim?
I think it's in Sefer Maasim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Can somebody ask a question less learned than that? sir, Rabbi Bob Baruch, who wrote his dissertation on another writer, a poet, who has some echoes of Appelfeld, namely Don Pagis. Rabbi Baruch.
I read a good deal of Appelfeld through the years, and though I like him very much and enjoy his voice and his style, it seems to me that he is a bit stuck with one narrative.
A bit stuck.
Yes.
Is Appelfeld stuck with one narrative?
And the narrative is most precise in Bodenheim 39.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you...
Well, we're going to ask Dr. Band to respond to that.
I don't think that's true at all, because a large percentage of his stories deal with families in the Austro-Hungarian Empire before World War II. It has nothing to do with the Holocaust, at least on the surface, it has nothing to do with the Holocaust. He has stories dealing with refugees who come and set up in Tel Aviv. And totally different from the Bodenheim stories. There's a great variety of things going on. It's true that experience is the seminal experience of his life. But what are you going to do? The Holocaust is not a minor matter.
All right, so we'll go to... there was a question here.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about Yoram Kanyuk. And do you think how... I think that Yoram Kanyuk was also an outsider, but... how do you compare Yoram Kanyuk?
The question is about a writer many may not know, Yoram Kanyuk, who's a very important novelist of the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000 even, and with some similarities to Appelfeld.
Well, Yoram Kanyuk does not have the Holocaust experience,
right.
Personal Holocaust experience. He does write about it, but he writes about it from the point of view of an Israeli. He's a very talented writer, but it's totally different, and his style is totally different from Appelfeld's style. There's one aspect of Appelfeld's style I'd like to mention. I've written about this, I've raised a question, and nobody to this day has answered me. And that is, if you read Appelfeld's style, you find something very peculiar to it. It is almost totally free of references, of echoes of Jewish texts.
That's correct.
In other words, Hebrew style, since Hebrew is such an old language, based on texts, Bible, Mishnah, stories, etc., etc., it's difficult to find. Moshe Shamir is filled with it. But Appelfeld, when you read Appelfeld, you don't find any references to Jewish. You get the strangest feeling. I mean, it's good Hebrew, but there aren't echoes of traditional Hebrew texts. I've written about this, soliciting reactions nobody's answered to me. And I brought this up once with a very important Israeli scholar from Bar Ilan, who knows Appelfeld extremely well and knows, has been reading Appelfeld from the beginning, sees him every week. And I asked him, I said, tell me something. I don't find any, and this guy's a rabbi, incidentally. And I said, I don't find any echoes of traditional Jewish texts, and something's missing. He said, no, you're crazy. We were on a committee. He went home and he came back the next day and he says, I've been up all night. I've been reading three or four books, and you're right. I've been reading for 45 years and I haven't, no one's ever discussed. I says, how do you explain it? I can't explain. But that's another side of him that makes it very interesting. It also makes it easy for him to translate him into German.
Excuse me, Aaron, are you saying that the young writers like, by young, I mean from the 50s, not today, but the Yehoshua use echoes of the classic Hebrew language?
Oh, sure. Sure. Always.
So there it was.
Yes, ma'am.
Of course, I agree, because Nathan Alterman...
Wait, you agree with what?
With Dr. Ben.
Not you.
Nathan Alterman, Ben. To drag Hebrew through the Chavot, because he's trying to free Hebrew from the biblical connotations. Amos Oz, in some of his stories, rewrote it And if you look word by word, I wrote about it, is to, whenever there's a word that has a connotation biblical, he will try to find a substitute, find the same story without the biblical connection, because they felt that it's choking the Hebrew language. They wanted the free. Now, Apfelfeld, because he was not raised in that environment, is free of the biblical.
Yes.
So I happen to think that young.
Well, we have one vote for Dr. Bannon, including 200 people here. Are there other questions? Yes, ma'am.
My name is Rubina Harumyan, and I'm Armenian, probably the only Armenian in the audience. Why I'm here? I'm here to pay my respect and my gratitude to Professor Arnold Band. 30 years ago, when I ventured, I was a graduate student at UCLA, Near Eastern Languages and Cultures Department, and I ventured to write my dissertation and into a very complicated topic, a comparison of the Armenian genocide literature and the Jewish Holocaust literature. And he was my guide. He guided me, as you said in your lecture, through the confusion of my first steps into Jewish Holocaust literature. Through you, you introduced me to Bialik and Apfelfeld and Agnon and David Roskies and Alan Means and others, and I thank you very much.
Thank you. Those who didn't hear, this wonderful person who finished her doctorate here as an Armenian wrote a dissertation trying to compare.
This is my latest book. I want
to
dedicate to you.
The relation of the Armenian genocide in literature by Rubina Harumyan. Thank you. And that leads me, I think it's going to be the final question. Arnie, you helped me about 6-7 years ago examine, because I couldn't read everything, about 50 Hebrew short stories and novels by young Israeli writers who weren't of European extraction in any way, but in which the Holocaust appeared as a kind of echo, a remnant, a trace. You may remember that, because you were doing you were being a judge in a literary contest, and you had boxes of books that I took home and read. And then I gave a paper on the fact that there are traces of the Holocaust in stories about all kinds of subjects. The trace may just be a kindergarten teacher who says something. It may be a soldier having a fantasy as he crawls through a tunnel. It may be somebody in the middle of the act of love saying, you know, this didn't happen in the Holocaust. I mean, strange things. Wouldn't those people... Well, I didn't mean that funny. I mean, this is a remarkable, you can read my paper in some obscure journal if you want, but the point is, I found that it appeared 50 or 60 times, and I wonder if those writers didn't draw on Apfelfeld in spite of what you said.
Oh, I'm positive, you know, writers are strange people. They read everything, and they say they never read it. But they're reading it. They clearly have read Apfelfeld, and they may not recognize or admit it, but they've read it. And they want to know what it's doing. Unfortunately, you know, there's still this popular stigma. He doesn't sell that many books in Israel for a good reason.
That's it.
For a good reason, and you know... It is the Sabra may be dead, but his ghost hovers over a lot of things.
Okay, so I'm gonna. There was a lady who.
I want to ask a question.
Then we'll have two questions and then we're done. Yes?
I will read something in Hebrew because I'm afraid that my English is not okay. Aharon Apfelfeld Hatam Pras, Israel. So he had a premium.
Yes. He won the Israel Prize.
Right. Yes, Israel Prize. So this is a very important thing.
Sure.
So, and they say Israeli hu oman hamishpat hamuzikali, that he is
the artist of the musical sentence.
So it's something that it's positive.
Of course.
Okay. Hayvrit shelo pshuta hamishpat mukpat ha alila zoremet velo omes ha tragi orev ach lamrot zot haroman pitov male osher. This is about Piton Ahava. This is the book Piton Ahava.
Can you translate a little bit?
Yeah.
This is about the book Suddenly Love.
Yeah, look, these statements, which is just on a blurb in the back of a book.
Yes.
Okay, that sounds like a statement on the blurb of the back of a book whose goal is to sell the book.
Yeah.
And all these things may be true to a certain extent. Probably I know the person who wrote that.
Madam.
Yeah, what I'm going to say is not that it,
this is important. This is your last.
No, I'm saying. Oh,
last
okay.
Person asking.
I'm going to have other chances, but what I want to say, I am in love. I don't know why they don't sell a lot of books in Israel, but I really discovered one up in the United States, not in Israel. But the thing is that for years and years and years, there is certain books of his that so nechretu in my mind, you know. I think it's
inscribed in her mind.
Appenfeld is so visual that I don't understand. Visual that I don't understand. I know that Menachem Golan, poor Menachem, wrote Button Button. You know, he wanted to do it as a film. And he wrote, I have the screenplay and all that. But there are so many of his books.
Tell me your question, madam.
No, it's almost like you said, that should be translated into movies, like Mesilot Barzel, for example. It just, what do you think about it?
Yes.